Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the People's School for Marxist-Leninist Studies. Today is January 30th, 2024, and tonight we will be doing a class on the 79th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. And as a special treat tonight, we'll be having Dr. Barry Latucci give us a lecture as well tonight. Just a few notes before we begin. The People's School of Marxist-Leninist Studies is a PCUSA initiated school, not a party affiliated school, so this does allow us a wide variety of different views to come in for discussion. And as always, PCUSA members, please keep your webcams on unless there's a valid reason. If you're unable to get your webcam on during the presentation, please try to call in as normal. And so I would like to turn the floor over to our speaker tonight, is Dr. Barry Latucci.
Well, thank you. You could just call me Barry, or you can call me Comrade. It's fine. You don't have to use any special titles, although I kind of prefer Comrade Professor. But that's I'm just kidding. You don't have to do that. Anyway, so I've been asked to say a few words about the liberation of Auschwitz and its commemoration on January 27th as International Holocaust Remembrance Day, something that really has only existed as an international day of commemoration since 2005. It was established by, at the United Nations. Oh, I didn't introduce myself fully. Okay, so yes, I'm the co-president of the Holocaust Memorial Committee, and which oversees the Holocaust Memorial Park, which is an outdoor museum on the Holocaust. Anyway, getting back to my presentation, I just wanted to say that that I wanted to give a pre say a few words about this day and this commemoration, so that we understand it from a socialist or communist or left-wing perspective, rather than allow it to be hijacked by the very same states and governments that actually were involved in the Holocaust and that even today promote genocide around the world. So we should really try to understand that the liberation of Auschwitz 79 years ago on January 27th is a day to be remembered and commemorated and owned really by communist socialists and the left, not by the imperialists. And there's a number of good reasons for that. First of all, it was the Red Army that liberated, the Soviet Red Army liberated Auschwitz on January 27th, 1945. And in fact, we can go further than that and say that it was the Soviet Red Army which caused the end of the Holocaust, because without the Soviet Red Army advancing on the Nazis would not have stopped the Holocaust. And it was that in itself which has to be given prominence in understanding this day. And I think most Jewish people understand that they owe a debt of gratitude to the Soviet Red Army for saving what remained of European Jews at the end of the Holocaust. I think most Jewish people do understand that to varying degrees, despite all the propaganda. Secondly, we have to remember it was the Soviet Union and the Russian Revolution which ultimately destroyed fascism. And that in itself is an enormous lesson in history, because the German communist leader Rosa Luxemburg wrote an article around toward the end of World War I in which she pointed out that the choice is between socialism or barbarism. And so the and that was because it became clear to people at the end of World War I that in fact the war was an imperialist war, And if they didn't choose socialism as the Russian Revolution had chosen, as Russia had chosen at the end of at in 1917, if the rest of the world didn't choose it, then they would be doomed to future wars, imperialist wars, in which there would be more genocide. So, and in a sense, that choice is still before us today, the choice of socialism or barbarism, right? I mean, because we see genocide going on against the Palestinians, against Russians and Ukrainians, all of this manipulated by the United States and its NATO allies, even to this day. So it's a very relevant lesson for us to draw from the liberation of Auschwitz. Thirdly, we have to understand that the Holocaust itself, and Auschwitz is, generally considered to be the most extreme example of the Holocaust, because it was the single place where the most Jews were killed, where the most killing took place in the shortest period of time in the most gruesome manner. That the Holocaust itself was a product of imperialism. So that's in itself a complete subject all unto itself that needs to be explained. Okay, so finally, also, in terms of the reasons why we should own the liberation of Auschwitz, is that also it wasn't just Jews who were killed. The leading target of the Holocaust in the Holocaust after Jews were communists. They were targeted above all, especially when, I mean, the Holocaust is generally considered to have really begun in 1941, and with the invasion of the Soviet Union in particular, the deployment of the special units for killing Jews was also designed to kill communists. Communists and Jews were targeted from the outset as the number one people to be captured and murdered in the Holocaust. And that also is a very, very important lesson. Also, the fact that Russians were also targeted as victims of genocide, which is not recognized by the U.S. Holocaust Museum, but should be. I can talk about that in greater depth at another in the discussion period, if you like. Briefly, a rundown description of Auschwitz is that Auschwitz had three components to it: Auschwitz I, Auschwitz II. This is Auschwitz II here, and Auschwitz III. And so out now we're looking at Majdanek, which is not part of Auschwitz, but anyway. The three parts of Auschwitz, the first part, the beginning part, was set up to in 1940, after the German army conquered Poland, set up to punish and torture Polish political prisoners. And then in 41, when it was decided now to use it to kill Jews, in 41, it was expanded to Auschwitz II, which is also known as Auschwitz-Birkenau, which there was a very good footage of Auschwitz-Birkenau earlier. I'm not quite sure if this is Auschwitz-Birkenau or not. And that's where Auschwitz, yeah, this is probably Auschwitz-Birkenau. So Auschwitz-Birkenau is the main part of Auschwitz, or Auschwitz II, as it's sometimes called, where most of the prisoners' barracks were, and also where the gas chambers and the crematoriums were. And then Auschwitz III was built, I think, in 42 as a further expansion for industrial slave labor. In other words, some companies were allowed to build factories for the war effort in Auschwitz III and to use Jewish slave labor in those factories. Most infamously, IG Farben, which was producing synthetic rubber. So, as I said, it was Auschwitz II where most of the killing took place, and where the gas chambers were, the crematoriums were, there were two there were two gas chambers. One could hold up to 900 people, and the second one that was built could hold up to 1,200 people in one massive room. They were shoved in there. Now, of course, and the crematoriums were built next to the gas chambers. The way it worked was, well, first of all, Auschwitz-Birkenau in particular was right on the train lines going connecting Western Europe, R Russia, and Southern Europe, and so it was an ideal place for this particular extermination camp. And I should say that Auschwitz was is called an extermination camp as opposed to simply a concentration camp because it's where it was designed specifically to kill the prisoners were not to be concentrated and just used for slave labor or torture or be prisoners, but were it was designed for as a killing camp. Also in Auschwitz II, well, the camp as a whole was run by the commander was an SS officer named Rudolf Hess, not to be confused with the other Rudolf Hess, who parachuted into Britain and then was served a life sentence in Spandau prison in West Berlin. This Rudolf Hess was after the war tried and convicted and hanged in 47. What's also unique about Auschwitz is the fact that the camp guards, in other words, the people who were running the camp, there were all it was only Germans. There were no collaborators. This was such an important project for the Nazis, for German fascism, that they didn't want to leave it. They didn't want to leave it to collaborators. They want only the SS, only SS officers work as camp guards at Auschwitz. and of course, the size of Auschwitz being several miles in circumference. It meant that it had a lot of other facilities, including laboratories for horrific experiments by the infamous Dr. Mengele. The most one of the most awful aspects of Auschwitz was the selection process itself, when the prisoners, most of whom were Jewish, were transported by rail to Auschwitz in cattle cars that were sealed and that had no air, no water for where people were dying actually in the cattle cars themselves. Once they, those who survived that journey were then placed on the train platform and SS officers selected some people to go to the left and some people to go to the right. The people who went to the left were destined to be sent to the gas chambers that day. And the ones on the right were destined to be slave laborers and not really expected to live, but live for a certain period to do things like help with moving the dead bodies from the gas chambers to the crematoriums and maybe work in the IG Farben factory and so on. And of course, all the children, hundreds of thousands of children who were immediately sent to the gas chambers, who had no opportunity, because the only people who were selected to live were people who seemed to have some usefulness as laborers. By the way, Mengele, who was one of the selectors on the platform, one of the main people doing that. And we're talking about perhaps 2,000 to 3,000 people arriving every day in these cattle cars. He survived the Holocaust because of these very same hypocritical states that pretend to own the Holocaust today, but which in fact, like the United States, actually Mengele was saved as a result of what are called the rat lines, which the Catholic Church basically provided escape routes for the ex-Nazis and other fascist murderers after the war, and was overseen by the U.S. Army intelligence. And so Mengele ended up escaping to Brazil and lived out a very long life in São Paulo, and died of natural causes in São Paulo in the 1970s. I know I've been going on maybe too long, but I should say, just I think in conclusion, we should also consider the goals of fascism, and understand that fascism, first of all, as a political ideology, only emerged at the end of World War I, and the primary purpose of fascism, aside from keeping capitalism and imperialism alive and suppressing the class struggle, was to destroy socialism and the Bolshevik Revolution. And there's a lot, and of course, it was combined with racial theory, also eugenics, which we can talk about if you like, and also this ultra nationalism, ultra militarism, a belief that people didn't have equal rights, that nobody should have, that only privileged races should have superior rights and everybody else should have no rights, and that in the end that they could be also destroyed or killed in what we would today call genocide, because the word genocide didn't exist as a word before 1948. But anyway, I guess I hope I've given you a brief rundown on what Auschwitz was and why the liberation of Auschwitz is important to socialists, communists, and people on the left, and why we are still why we need to remember commemorate this and understand this as a struggle against imperialism to this day, and it's still relevant to our day today. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Latucci. That was really informative. I enjoyed
I
that
hope
quite a bit.
so, and please call me Barry.
So we will break now for a discussion period. If you have a question or comment for Barry, please use the raise hand function and we will get to you as the hands go up.
Yeah, I want to thank Comrade Latucci for the, or Barry for the presentation. I learned from that because I didn't know that Auschwitz was created just for killing and like experiments, basically, because I knew the concentration camps, there were a lot of labor camps. That's what I know. It says there's like on the gate, it says like work will set you free, and they just work people to death. And during Professor Latucci's presentation, I read up on Rudolf Höss, and it looks like he studied Treblinka camp. And I guess Comrade Latucci can speak more on this, but there was a quote. I don't know if this is true or not, but he says, "Still another improvement we made over Treblinka was that at Treblinka, the victims almost always knew they were to be exterminated, and at Auschwitz, we endeavored to fool the victims into thinking that they were going through a delousing process."
Yeah, I forgot to mention that. That's actually true. Yeah, I just want to say that the actually, I think it's pronounced Hess because it's H. It's like HO with an umlaut, SS. But anyway, regardless of the pronunciation, he did write a lot of confession at the end of the war, which he thought would get him save his life, and of course it didn't. And so that's why we know so much about what he thought actually about these things.
On the gates to Auschwitz, it said "Arbeit macht frei," which is "work sets you free," which is a very dark irony, given that they were worked to death. All the concentration, all the workers, they were basically worked until they had nothing, no more strength left, and then were sent to the gas chambers. And there's a good book by he was actually a Polish communist. He was in the Polish The book was called "This w or Ladies and Gentlemen, This Way to the Gas Chamber" by Tadeusz Borowski, and it's really depressing, but it's also really well written, and I think it would shed a lot of light to people un to understand Auschwitz.
The footage that we were playing, if we have time, we can go to that actual audio. But in it, they talked about how a lot of the extermination started happening more towards the end of the war, as the Nazis were actually being pushed back from the Soviet army, and they were realizing that they had to hide a lot of this like this genocide that they were doing, and the internment camps, I guess. Can you speak about that? Like, I know, something about like when the final solution kind of
Oh,
came into.
sure. I'll just say a few words about it quickly. That the plans to, actually, the whole story about the so-called Jewish question in Germany, well, it became really a hot topic, or the idea actually of killing Jews or expelling Jews from Germany became a hot topic after World War I. Because the German generals, Ludendorff and Hindenburg, who ran the war effort at the end, claimed that that Germany had been stabbed in the back, and it was blamed on the Jews because it was blamed on socialist members of the Reichstag, and supposedly. Jews were responsible for that, and so this was one of the big myths that really sort of took off after World War I, and that Hitler jumped on and said, we didn't really need to lose World War I if it hadn't been for the Jews. See how they've destroyed Germany and how they are the traitors to Germany. So there was a long period before the Holocaust in which the fascist right and the far right in general, because the Nazi Party only got started in 1919. So there was a long period in which anti-Semitism and or anti-Jewish racism was discussed, and where extreme views like Hitler is saying we're going to get rid of the Jews in Germany, in Mein Kampf, but they didn't really have a definite plan until they decided to invade the Soviet Union, a decision that was taken in 1940, toward the end of 1940, they were already thinking about what they were going to do when they invaded the Soviet Union. And one of the things, of course, that they did was to create this special force called the Einsatzgruppen to deliberately murder Jews and communists in particular. And then after that, you had the question of what to do with the Jews in Poland, since Poland had been conquered, and the ghettos had been set up, like the Warsaw Ghetto and other ghettos where Jews were contained and expected to just die, and they didn't really have a definite plan. But by 41, as I mentioned, Auschwitz, among a few other camps, you can name them Majdanek, Sobibor, Belzec, Chełmno, and Treblinka, along with Auschwitz. Those six in Poland were going to be the destinations for the mass murder of Jews, and then that really started toward the end of 41. And the use of gas only started in December of 41, although gas had also been used in Serbia against the Jews captured in Serbia, because the Nazis went into Yugoslavia before they went into the Soviet Union, because Yugoslavia didn't go along with the tripartite pact in April of 41. So that delayed the invasion of the Soviet Union, and ultimately that was one of the reasons why the Nazis lost World War II also, is because they waited too long to invade in 41, and it was too late by the time they got to the gates of Moscow to capture it. But in any case, the Russians always make a joke about General Winter as being one of their greatest generals. So that's but it, basically by the end of 41, they had decided on using these extermination camps. And then that was promulgated at the Wannsee Conference in January of 42. And at the Wannsee Conference, basically everybody was let in on what was, the various commanders were it was explained basically at the Wannsee Conference, and we have the transcript of the Wannsee Conference, so we know exactly what they said there. And it was that was in January, and Wannsee, by the way, is a lake in Berlin. So there's the with it's kind of it was even then a kind of resort place and still is in Berlin. But the Wannsee Conference was where it was first like publicly mentioned that this is what we're going to do. We're going to exterminate the Jews in these extermination camps. I hope that answers the question. I don't know if it did or not, but
It did. Thank you.
oh, good. Okay.
Hello, Barry, and thank you for your beautiful presentation.
Thank you.
I wanna tell everybody they might know, but the day before the Remembrance Day of the Holocaust, the EU Commission under Ursula von der Leyen, non-elected, they said that Auschwitz-Birkenau was liberated by the Allied forces. As we know, at the end of January 44, the Allied forces were 500 miles to the west, nowhere near Auschwitz. Okay, so the Russian mission at the EU issued a statement, and then they had to correct themselves and say, yes, it was liberated by the Red Army, not the Allied forces. Okay. Second, I want to talk about the POWs, the prisoner of war, the Russian ones. Okay. As we know, the Red Army suffered terrible defeat, in 1941. So there were 3 million POWs, Soviet POWs. At the beginning of 42, 1 million out of those three were gone, were dead. Okay. And this is interesting is, the Holocaust began in Babi Yar in September 41, right? It was the Holocaust by bullets, no gas used, right? But at the same time, in September 41, in Auschwitz-Birkenau, they were shipping POWs, Soviet ones, and they tested the gas, the Zyklon B, on these POW, Soviet POWs, in September 41, same time as Babi Yar. And it was in a big test was 600 of them gone in the gas chambers. Okay, and I found that out in the official site of Auschwitz, auschwitz.org. It's interesting for comrades to go take a look. Thank you.
Yeah, Ursula von der Leyen. She embarrassed everybody noticed that she said the wrong thing about, but she did that deliberately. She was trying to deliberately lie and mislead people about the liberation of Auschwitz. She wanted to deny the truth about the liberation of Auschwitz, and she was called on it, and it was a kind of minor incident actually when that happened a few days ago, so yeah, your point is very well taken. Also, I you know the Russian people in particular were targeted, I believe, for genocide. I make this case it, partly because of what you said about the POWs, but and about and but really the thing that convinced me the most about the deliberate mass murder of Russians was the siege of Leningrad, and the fact that Hitler, who wanted during the war to try to pretend that he was above this and did not want to leave any evidence that he was giving the orders on this, he actually did come out during the siege of Leningrad and say, "We're not going to leave anyone alive there. We're going to finish them all off." And that was an open admission of planned genocide against the Russian people. Of course, there were many Jews in Leningrad too, but I think for me that really, and the fact that, you know, there, 1 million people were killed at Auschwitz, but 1 million people were also killed at the siege of Leningrad. So I just want to add that. Sorry.
Hi, I wanted to know more about like what your average working German's association with communism was. Did they have like anti-Semitic ideas about it? Was there a lot of propaganda associating Jewishness and communism, or were they just separately bad things that they
No, the German communists, German socialists in general were not anti-Semites. It was the anti-Semitic movement was very closely tied to not just the Nazis, but to the far right, who had an anti-materialist viewpoint on things, because the anti-Semitism in Germany was very much connected with this, not just with eugenics, but with also an idea of a spiritual occultism kind of idea that the German race was not only superior, but there was a spirit behind the German race that was going to annihilate the other races and expand and acquire Lebensraum. So, and also the fact that, you know, racism is a byproduct of imperialism. So by definition, most German leftists were anti-imperialist and anti-racist, although I can't say that all of them were. There probably were some exceptions to that rule, but in general, that, and of course, you know that the fascists were created to fight the communists from the very beginning, and they killed many of the leaders. They not only imprisoned them in the very first in the first concentration camps, but they also murdered so many of them, so I think everyone understood. And even before there were Nazis and the brown shirt, before there were the SS, there were the brown shirts, and even before there were the Nazis, there were the Freikorps, who were the very ultra-nationalists, militarists, you know. I think the German people realized in large part that the war had been an imperialist war. I think most people in Europe understood that. And so they didn't, they, it was only a certain segment of the population that really, particularly the pro-militarist and pro-imperialist and capitalist class, that really believed in this anti-Semitism and as a movement. But anyway, I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, so I just wanted to see what you have to say about this. So I had read an article years ago explaining how the Germans committed war crimes, and one of their tactics of war was to obviously try and blame the Jews or the communists on this, or somehow blame the Soviets. But, you know, any inkling of any real research will immediately backlash against them and realize, no, it had to be the Germans that did this. Is there any kind of, you know, record of that? Because it's a war, it gets messy, it's going to be hard to capture all the details, of course. But there obviously has to be a record if even an individual journalist is able to obtain some information.
A record, could you narrow that down again? A record of.
Of situations where they would just literally blame the Soviets or other people about, any kind of war crimes that happened during that era. Because I
Oh,
know
I
that was a tactic
right.
they used.
Well, of course, they wanted to do a lot of what they didn't want to publicize necessarily what they were doing. As somebody, I think I forget now who pointed that out, but they even tried to they tried to keep it as quiet as possible, because that was to their advantage. But I don't know. I mean, it's like there's lots of examples that I can't really remember too many off the top of my head, but yeah, the Nazis tried to, there's some really good examples, but I off the top of my head, I can't think of, maybe somebody else can. I'm sorry.
Wasn't like the bombing of like some parliamentary building was blamed on the communists when it was
Oh, the Reichstag
the
burning.
rest of
Burning
it.
of the Reichstag. Yeah, the Reichstag was burned in 33, right after Hitler. Hitler became chancellor in January of 1933. He was chosen to be chancellor by Hindenburg and by the support of the right-wing parties, because really the capitalist class understood that they needed a fascist leader. They needed Hitler at that time. And so after Hitler became chancellor, the Nazis organized the burning of the Reichstag, so that it, which was convenient, so that they could then shut down the Reichstag permanently. And Hitler had said at a meeting before this happened, and there is a written record of this. So yeah, this is a very good example, actually, to answer Sanjay's question. There's a written record of, in fact, a transcript of the meeting of Hitler and Goering with bankers and industrialists before Hitler was chosen to be chancellor. And he said in that transcript, it's a very vivid memory that I suddenly have, that this would be the last election for at least the next 10 years and possibly for the next 100 years. So they had planned to burn the Reichstag to create an incident where they could then blame it on the communists and then use that to enforce laws to outlaw the other parties in the right in Germany and arrest them. So that's, yeah, perfect setup. But that's a good example of what I was asking about, I think.
Thank you, comrades. In keeping with the spirit that you're saying that the stuff that happened then is extremely relevant still today. My question is, as an expert on this, based upon the situation in our country at the current moment, given the dangerous crossroads this country is at, do you see the same stuff repeating itself potentially dangerously here in this country, like it did there, especially coming from the extreme far right in this country, and the fact that they've publicly stated they get in there, they're going to get rid of as many of us as possible with ruthless force if they have to? And if so, what would be your suggestion of what we could do about it?
Wow. That's the last part in particular is really I don't even have the answer for it, to be honest. But I would say yes, it is a very dangerous time, and yes, it is relevant to the. I mean, we have people in government right now who are promoting genocide. Like the one that constantly comes up in my mind is that senator from South Carolina named Lindsey Graham, who is, who wants to bomb I Iran now, and who publicly on camera said that, we should kill as many Russians as we possibly can. I mean, these are people who would drag us into a nuclear holocaust. So your point is well taken about the depth of the crisis we're facing, and the the dangerous aspects of that. But as far as what to do about it, I wish I had a better answer for you. I just don't. I just hope. I mean, I really wish there was a third candidate, somebody other than Biden or Trump to vote for, because both of those candidates to me seem to me to be more genocide and more war. Even though Trump had a good, relatively clean record in comparison to the to Biden, but I don't trust Trump at all to keep us out of war. And Biden has already proven, he's already acquired the name Genocide Joe. So I think that speaks for itself.
Thank you. So I was just wondering about the publicity of the concept of the Final Solution and of the German sentiment towards it. I mean, I would assume obviously that it was probably well known within the Nazi Party, especially the higher ranks of the Nazi Party, that it was going on. But did the German people understand the sheer like tragedy of what was happening in Auschwitz? And did the German people support this? And looking back at the matter, after World War II was over, I remember there was a survey about what the German sentiment was towards the Nazi Party, and a lot of them just denied it and were like, he was just a leader. But contemporarily, was there a lot of German knowledge of this, and did they support it?
I don't want to oversimplify that, because that's a very complicated matter, but you know, the SS certainly knew about it. So the high command of the SS knew about it, and even in the Wehrmacht they knew about it, because the SS was integrated into the military system. As for the average German, I think it was very divided. I mean, obviously Nazi ideology was the only politics in Germany for 12 years. And it did seep into the public, and we have to remember that this generation lived on into the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, and even into the 2000s. There may be even some still alive even today. A lot of them never changed their attitude, but on the other hand, there was a large population which opposed the Nazis, that emigrated. It's a tragedy in that so many people were convinced, but after I think that most people did not know what was going on. I mean, if the average person probably did not know that Auschwitz was doing what it was doing with the gas chambers, I don't think the average person would have known that. But on the other hand, the anti-Semitism was very widely disseminated by the Nazis as part of their program, as was anti-socialism, anti-communism. All of that was, you know, part and parcel of what people were raised to believe in. And of course, you know, what the fascists did very successfully, unfortunately, was that they miseducated a younger generation. They took children and they educated them as Nazi youth to adopt the ideology of the Nazis. And a lot of those youth went on to be lifelong Nazis. And of course, not very few, relatively few Nazis were actually punished. I mean, a lot of, there were people at SS guards after the war who were prosecuted, tried and prosecuted, and they only received 10 years sentence. So yeah, a lot of them just went on with their normal lives and continue to hold the same views. But for the most part, relative to other places like in the Ukraine or Croatia, where there had been a majority fascist leadership, Western Ukraine anyway. They at least did get a re-education after World War II. At least a younger generation was taught that the Nazi ideology was a terrible tragedy for the German people, which it was, because 8 million Germans died as a result of Hitler's government and rule, misrule. I'm sorry, I can't answer that perfectly. I don't like to go along with the idea that it's a kind of collective guilt that the Germans should have, because from a Marxist perspective, a scientific perspective, you have to understand that this was the capitalist class ideology that was that prevailed and that promoted genocide.
Before we get to some of the other hands, though, actually, you did mention something I wanted to kind of follow up on a little bit. So you mentioned some of the movements in Croatia and Western Ukraine that had the fascist leadership. Was there any current connection to the present and any connection with the fascist call for genocide and what could be going on with current events? And could you also maybe, I know we're probably familiar with the fascists in Ukraine. Can you give a little on the ones in Croatia as well? Thank you.
Right. Well, the ones in what's interesting about all of the fascists, whether they were Croatian, Ukrainian, German, Romanian, whatever, they were the United States and Great Britain made a definitive decision at the end of the world war at the end of the war to save them and to use them in the Cold War struggle against communism immediately after the war. I mean, some Americans were very out, came right out and said we should just continue the war until we capture Moscow. And so, I mean, that wasn't necessarily Roosevelt's idea. The people in the Roosevelt administration were not the main promoters. It was really when Truman came in, Truman really had the decision, and his followers really had this decision. But so in the case of Croatia, what happened is that the Croatians had a state in World War II, which was a pro-fascist, pro-Nazi state, and which basically on its own carried out its own genocide against Serbs, Jews, and Romas. So it was different than in the Soviet Union or in Poland, in that Russians were not targeted, but rather Serbs were targeted, because Croats actually in the independent state of Croatia in World War II did not comprise a full majority of the population. There was a large population of Serbs, Romas, and Jews in the independent state of Croatia, which included Bosnia. Anyway, those fascist leaders, for the most part, escaped at the end of the war, a lot of them. And they were saved by the United States and Great Britain, and they went through the rat lines. They were saved by the International Red Cross and the Catholic Church, etc. And when the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, the one communist country that still remained, I mean, aside from Albania and Yugoslavia remained standing after the Berlin Wall came down and after the Soviet Union was dissolved. And the United States was determined, along with its NATO allies, was determined to destroy Yugoslavia, and it imposed elections in each of the republics because of the leverage the United States had with the IMF and the IMF loans on Yugoslavia. And they imposed that, and this was a condition for the economic survival of Yugoslavia. So Yugoslavia held these elections in 1990 and in 1991, sorry. And in 1991, the Croatian right-wing government was nationalist government was elected thanks to US propaganda. And all of the Croatian fascists who were still alive left, Argentina, Canada, Australia, United States, and landed in Croatia to help lead this what became the Yugoslav Civil War. And so, you know, the United States saved these Nazis, these Croatian Ustasha Nazis, and deployed them when it was time to destroy what remained of the Yugoslav communist state in 1991. So that's, I guess, in a nutshell, the answer to your question.
Thank you,
I hope
Dr.
it helps. I hope
Yes, yes, it
it
did,
helps. And
definitely.
call me Barry, please, Nick.
Of course. Sorry, Barry.
That was very interesting. So I just wanted to add, kind of going back, that in addition to the six ghettos that you mentioned, Auschwitz, in contrast, there was Theresienstadt, which I think was a Potemkin village of sorts. It was like a propaganda camp, which is kind of interesting.
Concentration. It was a concentration camp, but
It
you
ended
meant
up being
the six were the extermination camps. The ghettos were an entirely different thing. The ghettos were actually before the extermination camps, and there were ghettos in every occupied area of, that the Germans occupied, in which where they didn't necessarily come right out and kill the Jews, but rather kept them in like it was almost like a concentration camp in that it was usually in the poorest part of a particular town or village or city, like the Warsaw Ghetto or the, you know, there were lots of ghettos all over where the Jews were herded into, and sometimes they would be later deported to the death camps, or sometimes they would stay in the ghettos until they died of starvation or disease. I hope I addressed what you were asking.
Latucci, Barry's comment about like the need another candidate other than Biden and Trump. There's also like Marianne Williamson running Democrat primary, and also Cornel West running as an independent, and Jill Stein running in the Green Party. And also, I was thinking, like, wasn't it true that for a while, like, the Soviet Union listed the dead at Auschwitz at 4 million, but it's actually like
Oh,
only about
yeah.
1 million? How did that happen?
Yeah, that's a very interesting it's kind of a detail of hi the history of Auschwitz that they overestimated the actual numbers of people who were murdered there. And for a long time, it was like for a few decades they had the, until they it was corrected. Because they the one thing that the Germans didn't do is they didn't destroy all the records of people transported to the camps. And so there is some extensive record keeping. And so in any case, historians by the by around 1990 or thereabouts began to correct the historical record and say it was 1 million Jews, not 2 million Jews. And I mean, I don't think it was, you know, it's not like some terrible crime was committed here. It was just a refinement of our understanding of what happened there. The total number of people killed there was is still not known exactly, but it's believed to be 1.5 to 2 million. So there were a lot of non-Jews who were killed there. But we don't know the exact number of in that case, and and we'll never know. We will never know. That's true of a lot of the people who died in World War II. We just don't know the exact number and the exact identity of everybody who was killed. We have a rough idea, not a perfect idea.
Yes, I just wanted to ask you about you mentioned earlier that there were other people who were also targeted for the concentration camps other than Jewish people, like Russian people, communists.
Romas.
I wanted to ask about the there. I mean, there were far more groups than that as well, like Romani people, gay people, disabled people, people of different like religious backgrounds. Black people, if they were there, and I find it interesting that you mentioned they kept extensive records of all of the people who they kept in the camps. Do they have any sort of records of, I guess, the other groups that were mentioned, and if they didn't record those groups so extensively, is there any particular reason why they wouldn't?
Right. That's actually, yeah, that's really good points you brought up. One of them that I really want to just quickly say something about, you mentioned people with physical and mental disabling characteristics, or who are disabled in one way or another. Actually, those were the first people who were gassed. That was the first group, and that's believed to there is a pretty good estimate on the total number of disabled people who were gassed. Now, these are Germans, right? These are Germans who were gassed in Germany, who were taken out of hospitals or out of clinics or out of their homes and were brought and gassed. The number is 80,000. I mean, I've seen 70 to 90,000, but 80,000, I think, is a, you know, that's a pretty clear number of people who with disabilities who were gassed. They were called useless eaters by the Nazis, and so they had to be eliminated. But this is again part of the racism of Nazi, but fascist. Now, I don't even want to call it Nazi ideology. I want to call it fascist ideology, because fascists still believe in this kind of racial theory. They still believe that some people don't deserve equal rights. That's a hallmark of fascism, is that some people deserve all the rights and some people deserve no rights. In fact, they deserve to be eliminated, and that is part of the benefit of being in the master race, and keeping the master race or the superior races healthy is by eliminating people like disabled people so that they don't reproduce and so on, or they're simply exterminated. And so, yeah, that's, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think I meant to talk about it, but I didn't. And also, as far as the Romas are concerned, the Romas existed, the Romas who the derogative term or the negative term terminology is gypsy, because it just is. And so the Romas were targeted from the get-go also as one of the people to be eliminated. Again, it all goes back to this pseudoscience of eugenics, which is the idea that, first of all, racial theory in general believed that there are races, which is a false theory to start with. You know, the whole notion at the very beginning that Homo sapiens are divided into subgroups or subspecies is nonsense, and scientific nonsense, pseudoscience. But it was popularized because of imperialism. It was part and parcel of promoting the socioeconomic system of capitalism and imperialism, just as the minstrel shows in the United States were promoted to justify slavery, and then later Jim Crow racism in the United States. Same thing here with this social Darwinism and eugenics, which was a pseudoscience which claimed that there were different races, subspecies of the Homo sapiens species, which doesn't exist. And so there were, the Romas were another group that were targeted for extermination, because that was harmful to the German race, just as the Jews were harmful to the German race. And so these are long-term fascist concepts, and still today, certain people under U.S. imperialism are deemed better than other people. We still think that Palestinians don't deserve equal rights, or we're told that, and we're told that Russians are demonized. You know, the demonization of the of certain groups. So that it's all part of the larger plan of capitalist imperialism to eliminate these groups or to destroy them in one way, militarily.
Yeah, so I'm going to touch on what you talked about earlier, Barry, about the recycling of Nazi leaders in the United States after 1945. And this week, I found out on Telegram, there is Russell Texas Bentley, you know, our brother
I know him.
In the Donbass. And he posted on his channel something interesting that was done by Info Defense. I think it's a French site on Telegram. They uncovered a CBS 60 Minutes clip.
I saw it. I saw it.
Yes. Yes. Awesome.
And, yes, it was. But you know what? That it's old news, because there's tons of literature out there explaining, you know, I saw that exact same clip that you mentioned. It's all over the internet, where CBS in 1982 did a program, and that was just when the story was breaking about the rat lines. That was oh goodness, I know the whole story so well, but I can't quite explain exactly how the story broke in the news, but 60 Minutes did cover it. How the U.S. Not only saved but employed all of these Nazi war criminals, and not just Germans but collaborators like Ukrainians and so on, and Croats and others in the Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, in various capacities in the U.S. government and in U.S. Foreign intelligence. And that's why the policy on the Ukraine is the way it is because that was so thousands of Ukrainian fascists, as well as Belarusian fascists and others, were brought and incorporated into the foreign policy establishment. And now their children and grandchildren are still working in that establishment. I mean, it's the what do they call it? Forget now the terminology that's used, but it's like the government with the government without behind the government, you know. I forget what the terminology is, but yeah, I saw that clip, and there's such an extensive literature on this, and I teach it in my class. I make sure that when I teach a class at Brooklyn College or wherever, you know, in particular, I use that literature. Christopher Simpson wrote two excellent books on this, and he was one of the early people to break the story and did a wonderful documentary on it back in 1989 or 88 called Hotel Terminus, which if you could view it, you'd find that very interesting. The documentary about searching for these rat line people.
I have a question for Barry Latucci. And by the way, I've learned during this presentation about that a comrade mentioned they're in Synstat. I guess that was like a model city or a model concentration camp where they tried to make the Nazis made it seem like the Jews were just being moved east. It was like this fun adventure to go labor. Really, they were killing everybody. But my question was, were there any uprisings in Auschwitz?
Because there was actually. There was an uprising in 44 by the Sonderkommandos. They, of course, most of them died or were killed. But they did manage to kill a good number of SS men. I think that was in August of 44. Of course, the Sonderkommandos were the ones who did the worst possible labor. They had to drag the dead bodies to the crematorium from the gas chambers and stuff like that. And so they were replaceable. They when they got too weak to work, they were killed too. And so they planned an uprising. And there's at least one other case, but that's the one that immediately pops to mind was the the uprising of the Xunder commandos in 44.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, I've heard that FDR modeled a lot of his programs, like the Conservation Corps, on Nazi Germany's programs and sort of what purpose they had there.
Ooh, that's a tough one. I'm afraid I'm not knowledgeable about that, to be honest. You got me on that one. You definitely.
Thanks. Okay. Thank
sorry,
you.
Sorry, I don't know the answer to that. I'm sorry.
I could answer that.
Okay.
Go ahead.
In the beginning, the party, the Communist Party, did not support Hitler. I'm sorry. Did not Roosevelt. Support FDR.
Right.
That should be understood. And we had our own candidate in the presidential election. One of the reasons is that the symbol that the Roosevelt administration used in one of its programs for the New Deal, I don't know if it was the National Recovery Act, NRA, one of them had the same exact eagle that the Nazis used, the same one, only it didn't hold the swastika. But it was the same thing with it. It's a big picture of an eagle with their claws holding something. And the other thing, which is more important, the Civilian Conservation Corps, CCC, was modeled after what was going on in Germany in the early days, where they had places in the West where they built dams and parks. They used American youth who had no jobs, who were unemployed. They went and they were like in a uniform and they lived there. And that was a fact that we had a position against the CCC, and that the party did, that it reminded us of what was going on in Germany before the actual rise to power, while Hitler, when he just came in. So there was a lot of literature written on that, by the way. Thank you.
Thank you, Comrade Angelo.
So whenever the Hindenburg crashed, didn't the United States fly the swastika at one point? Thank you.
I think you're right. And I, of course, you know, we recognized Nazi Germany. So, you know, of course, the Nazi flag flew. There were, you know, there was a very large German-American population that supported Adolf Hitler in the United States and continued to support him even after he was defeated in World War II. I know because I grew up in a German-American neighborhood in New York City called Yorkville in Manhattan. And we had a neighbor who still had a poster of Hitler on their wall in the 1960s. And I can tell you this was very frightening to us and to me in particular. I trick-or-treated one year when I was about 6 or 7 and got an apple with a razor blade in it. So I can tell you there was a still very strong Nazi sentiment among some German Americans in New York City, even in the 1960s and in 1970s.
I urge you to get, I don't know if it's on YouTube, excellent movie called Hitler's Children. Hitler's Children, which shows, it's a story about a girl, a German young girl who was an American. Her parents went back to Germany. But it shows what Barry's talking about. We had camps during the summertime in this country that were run by the German-American Bund. And they were actually in this movie. By the way, the director, very important, was Edward Dimitrik. Edward Dimitrik is one of the Hollywood Ten. And he was a member of the CP. So you should write this down. Hitler's Children by Edward Dimitrik shows the whole story is about the German-American Bund in this country and the camps that we had here. And they were modeled after what was going on in the homeland in Germany when Hitler just came in. I urge you, if you want to learn the history of what was going on in this country among German Americans, is to get this movie. Thank you.
Yeah, one of the things I wanted to ask Barry while he's here is, you know, here in the United States, we hear a lot about how Adolf Hitler and the Nazis were inspired by different, you know, racial theories and racist groups in the United States and the genocide that took place against the indigenous people. I wanted to ask you to what extent that's true that they were inspired by that, and if they were inspired by more than that, and if we make too much of it here, just what your perspective is on that.
There's no question they were inspired by it. I mean, they definitely, the Nazis... The Nazis definitely were, and Hitler in particular. I mean, he was a big fan of Henry Ford and other prominent spokespeople for, well, not just anti-Semitism, but for racial theory in general. And racial theory in the United States was so widespread. I mean, every president up to Franklin Roosevelt gave speeches praising eugenics and racial theory. I mean, if you look at Hoover, Coolidge, Harding, Wilson, they were all racists, and TR before that. And so they all were, you know, in the United States, when a racist wanted to find out if somebody else was a racist, they would say, "Is he a good race man?" And you know, if they say, "Oh yeah, he's a good raceman. Oh, that's good." You know, then I know he believes in eugenics and racial theory. And the United States ate up racial theory even before Germany did, because if you go back to the 1850s, Gobineau's book on superior and inferior races was a bestseller in its translation in the United States. And so, yeah, they had lots of, the Nazis had lots of good examples in the United States. And the, you know, the mass murder of indigenous or native peoples in the Americas, as well as the, you know, mass murder and enslavement of Africans, that was praised, you know, in by the Nazis and said it was a good example for them. So yeah, there's no question. I don't think it can be it's not underestimated. I don't think, if that's the part of your question.
Comrade Barry, I just wanted to go ahead and say thank you so much for your time tonight. I really, really appreciate all of the knowledge that you've given us. It has been so enlightening. For any of the folks on this call who want to dig deeper, who want to learn more, particularly from our ideological perspective, are there any works, be that film, books, whatever, that you would recommend us to look at specifically?
Definitely Chris Simpson's book, Blowback. Chris, that's a good place to start. And his second book, The Splendid Blonde Beast. Charles, and of course, he did that documentary, Hotel Terminus, which is, you know, very, very interesting to watch. And, you know, Charles Allen was a great... you know, writer on this subject. Didn't write a lot, but he did write good stuff and was one of the earliest people on this subject. There's a very good book called Racial Hygiene by, hold on. Robert Proctor. That's a really good book because it really goes into the whole theory of racial hygiene by Robert Proctor is a wonderful book on how that whole, how the racial theory came about. Oh my goodness, I can't, I mean, that's just stuff that comes to the there's other good stuff, and I just wish I should have made up a list, but I'm sorry I didn't do that. Maybe I could do that in the future. A list of reading and films on this subject.
Yeah, so I just wanted to remind people that last year Russia was banned from attending the International Holocaust Remembrance Day in Auschwitz, by a far-right Polish president who also invited the leader of a fascist regime in Ukraine, who I believe just days prior posted pictures of Ukrainian soldiers with swastikas and what do you call it? The skull logo. I can't think of the name, but just days prior
Death
to
head,
the
death head, death head.
the death head. So just days
Which, by the
prior.
way, was the SS unit or division that guarded Auschwitz, as a matter of fact.
Well, so I just wanted to bring this to people's
60
attention
seconds.
that we can't, forget what they did, the liberators of Auschwitz being banned from attending. But I'd like to also just say thank you very much, Barry. This was a great class.
My understanding is that the Nazis, when they w went into Poland, that they selected certain Polish individuals, like children, that were part like blonde hair, blue eyes, and that they would, I guess keep the other ones in bad conditions. But similar to how Americans kept Native Americans, like in I guess like schools, specific schools or something. Maybe you could speak about that, but also I think we're running out of time, but I was hoping you could mention something about the actual liberation of Auschwitz, what the Red Army witnessed, if you had anything on that, and that's it.
Just a few words on that, and that we should remember also that the Red Army and Soviet doctors saved the lives of the 7 or 8 thousand people who were still in the camp when the Soviet Army liberated it on January 27th, and that should be remembered also as a very important deed. I would just, if this was, I don't know if this is my last round of comments, but I just want us to return to the, if I were going to leave you with something, I would leave you with the idea that the struggle of against fascism that the Red Army led and that the communists led in World War II and won is still a valid issue today, and it's still an inspiration for us, because imperialism is not going to go away quietly or without committing more genocide. And the liberation of Auschwitz and the victory over fascism in World War II, very important to our contemporary understanding of what our tasks are in 2024.
Thank you so much, Dr. Latucci, for everything, all the wisdom you have given us tonight, and for taking time out of your schedule to come talk with us. Before we go to wrap up, though, Comrade General Secretary Angelo, do you have any closing remarks?
No, I just want to mention that I had the pleasure and the honor of knowing Barry for many years. I met Barry originally over the issue of American when they did to Yugoslavia in the early 90s. And we worked very closely with Sarah from Workers' World Party at the time. Just can't remember Flounders.
Angela, we met in the 80s, actually, but you don't remember. We met at a meeting with Sam Marcy.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it was Sam Marcy speaking that night, and I remember you were sitting right behind me.
Oh, that's interesting. See, you remember more than I do.
Well, I can't forget that, so yeah.
Okay, but and so I kept a personal friendship with Barry when he had the birth of his son. I remember that.
Yes,
and he was a great father. He went out of his way to try to spend time with his son. And that impressed me also. But I want to thank Barry for working with us tonight. And I want to just also, I have to mention that Barry's mom, I got to always mention your mom, Barry, was secretary in a group called the American Slav Congress when Tito was leading the partisan movement against fascism in Yugoslavia. So that's all. Thank you.
Yes, that's that's, and she also was a part of many other, I guess you could call them front organizations in the 40s. But anyway, that's another story.
And we will go to the International for a closeout.
We were possessed of all their flavors. Let us consult for all.
Thank you for watching this full-length class from the People's School for Marxist-Leninist Studies. For more information or to join our free classes, visit our website, check out our YouTube, listen to our streams on Spotify, and chat with us on Reddit.